So I'm going to reduce the screen that shows all of the names of comrades and friends, and then hopefully put up the little introductory talk that I've prepared, and just go through it in my own way and see how we get on. Okay, I've got my script in front of me now, but I'm more than happy for people to sort of, you know, would they put a hand up, Paddy? Is that how they would do it? Or just,
yeah, you know, can just, do.
Yeah, or just ask to, you know, sort of interrupt, politely interrupt. It's not a problem. Right, okay, some words I'll just put out. These are just headlines, really, which are not in the talk. It's essentially a thing like, you know, not all, you know, not only but also. So there are words out there at the moment that are in the discourse, the public discourse. We've got words like populism. We have words like authoritarian. We've got huge sort of debate about migration. A whole academic sort of area of study for globalization, for things like nationalism, things like NATO and the former Iron Curtain. So I'm just sort of going to say things as I sort of see them. It's not a particularly socialist analysis at all. It's a fairly sort of moderate mainstream one, I think, to be honest, but just from somebody that's you know, looking at it from a non-expert point of view. But it seems to me that it certainly across the wider continent of Europe, liberal democracies are in a fragile state, and that simple messages of, you know, with sort of xenophobia and attempts to undermine legitimate sort of democratic institutions have quite a receptive audience. And in the not so distant past, there are certain countries in particular, which, you know, I don't have a great deal of in-depth knowledge about what's actually going on there. But I just know that there are trends happening. We have France and Austria, where populist parties have moved sort of beyond the fringe and have run as really serious contenders in national elections. And then we have Hungary and Poland, where actually these types of governments are now actually in charge. And so sort of it's a fact, really, I suppose, that you know, quite a large part or considerable part of the European population can be quite comfortable living in elected sort of systems, elected jurisdictions, which are pretty authoritarian. And maybe some of these people, you know, will obviously find, you know, some of that appealing. You know, things like quite tight, you know, security and quite tight surveillance and compromised individual liberties and very uniform sort of structures that are imposed within society, and look for current and you know, for some sort of backward looking role models on this. And some of it, perhaps, what it is, you know, it seems to me anyway, comes from and echoes the 1930s, when fascism in Europe was on the rise and received considerable support from its sympathisers, even within developed democracies. And in the UK, We had the obviously we had the British Union of Fascists under Oswald Mosley. Now, I think that to compare today's populists across Europe with yesterday's fascists is a stretch, you know, to say the least. But even given their limited role, they present with sort of, on the surface with more benign attitudes. But there are, possibly some legitimate concerns that they point up and articulate through their, their public presentation of their appeal. So the next sort of section, I suppose, in this brief talk that I was looking at was how is this looked at through the eyes of, through British eyes. I'll put a little title up for myself, The Political Malaise in Europe Through British Eyes. And I think, I'm looking at this really through the prism of Brexit, to be honest. There's no real original insight here. Again, it's something that I think most of us are aware of. But like for mainstream observers and mainstream sort of political activists, if we want to put it that way, it seems as though the attitude towards Brexit and the EU is just one of the clearest indicators of where people stand politically. Generally speaking, Remainers who regret Brexit and want to rejoin the single market or even the European Union, then are generally speaking almost always on the centre to left of the sort of formal political spectrum. And within the left-right paradigm, if people are an ardent leaver and still support Brexit, even if they're disappointed with the outcomes and the failure of, as they see it, of government to take advantage of it, then they're pretty surely on the right of the political spectrum in sort of traditional terms. There are some exceptions, and I was told recently about this sort of concept that there's now sort of called Lexit, where you've got some quite kind of like, well, people that regard themselves on the left wing, such as this Mick Lynch, who's a union leader for the rail workers. He's very firmly on that side of, but it seems that the general rule sort of holds, but perhaps that's because Brexit stands as a sort of a proxy, really, for a range of issues, other issues, other things that people, can be tickled to be concerned about by the media and by the state, and the way that the hegemony that people are sort told to to sort of made to sort of think through, it sort of happens, So, I mean, one of those is migration, and that's a hot topic at the moment. It has been for some time, but it seems now that given that the ruling class across Europe is really struggling to have any real leadership in terms of on this issue, it's sort of playing its most sort of cruel and most, lowest common denominator card, really, which we've probably all seen in the news just over the past week or so. But then history sort of suggests that this sort of state of affairs is not always necessarily been the case, and not always would be the case. So, I mean, for example, within this mainstream sort of strands of thought, it's sort of like it was the right wing, really, the centre right, and people like Mrs. Thatcher, who were really strongly in favour of closer links with Europe originally. Thatcher championed the European single market, and in 1983, leaving the EEC, which was the forerunner of the European Union, the European Economic Community, it was a central part of the Labour Party's programme as well. Whilst anti EEC people in the Conservatives are quite a small minority, a bit like today's left wing anti sorry today's Lexiters, the sort of left wing Brexiteers. But all that then changed sort of roughly between 1987 and 1983, and the Tories, the Conservatives, became increasingly sceptical, and in some parts of the Conservative Party became very formally hostile towards the European project, as they became aware of the goal of what this could the ultimate outcome could be. Which would be a closer political union, as they called it at the time, and then at the same time, the left saw the EU as a sort of a bulwark for their values of social liberalism and intervention in the market economy. But I think this is what sort of it like triggered me to say something about this. It seems as though to me that something similar could happen over the next decade. And I know that this isn't really touching on our case at all, but I think we just need to be mindful of it, and I'm sure we are. And part of that is that the liberal left will probably fall out of love with European politics. And become alienated from the direction the EU is taking now, well, I think it is the case actually. I think it's already in process that the right become more attracted to the EU, and see it as the best vehicle for utilising and realising their goals. And so it could be, and this is a sort of a bit of a leap of well, a questionable leap at the moment, but it could actually be that the right wing ultimately will see. I'm not necessarily talking about Britain here. I'm talking about the whole swathe of continental Europe. And also, obviously, stretching out as far now as the border of Russia, really, we'll see the EU as a platform to take their sort of demands and the interests of those units of the work of the ruling class forward, and to the denigration. Well, not necessarily the denigration, but certainly to no advantage of the working class. And I think another element in this is this thing that is it seems to really becoming quite a prevalent thing now. I wouldn't say necessarily with social media. I mean, social media is already one area that is out there for the younger generations and for a lot of the older generations now as well. But there is this, in the absence of any real class politics, a transformation towards the culture war politics. So you've got the right wing across Europe now. It's sort of becoming defined more by an opposition to any kind of cultural challenges and lifestyle challenges that sort of originated in America. And probably a good example of that is a country like Hungary, which, whereas the EU can be quite an attractive place for a leader like Viktor Orban to situate himself because it's quite strategically important. But, the kind of cultural background in Hungary is not really conducive. I know a little bit about Hungary. I spent some time there when I was younger, and I know that they kind of have a quite a difficult sort of approach to more sort of socially liberal things that in perhaps in places like Germany and Britain and France that are far more sort of acceptable now, things like homosexuality and other issues along those lines, really. Gender, even gender issues, and sort of in some parts of Hungary, places like places I've been, if you are not married, and you're my age, like people make assumptions about you, that sort of thing. So there's that, and you've got sort of similar. I'm not able to speak on it with any great authority, but you've got the same sort of things happening in maybe in Poland as well, on that front. So then again, you've then got another sort of a trend in Central Europe, in Italy, with Giorgia Meloni, the head of the government in Italy now. She heads up a party which is a sort of coalition of forces, really, I think. But they have quite blatant sort of neo-fascist roots. And then in Finland as well, there's a far right group called the Finns that have joined the coalition there. So also, I'm coming towards the end now, actually. But the other one to keep an eye on is the AfD, the Alternative for Deutschland party in Germany, and the obviously Marine Le Pen's National Front in France as well. So, where am I heading with this? I mean, I'm not trying to come across as having any great understanding, really. I'm trying to make sense of this myself. I look back actually before I put this sort of thing hastily together, and I looked at the Socialist Standard from 1938, and there was an article then by a comrade at the time. I'll look his name up first, but his name was Harry Waite. And ultimately, I think Harry summed this up really well. These things are always in flux. It's always, sort of nobody really is sure what's really going on. The article was about is there going to be another war? And this was written in April 1938. And end of the day, I don't think we were really sure if there was going to be another war. But I just worry that trends and developments across Europe are sort of getting a bit scary now. And I haven't brought in anything about Ukraine or about, you know, NATO and the USA getting their claws into pushing the Iron Curtain back and all that sort of thing. There's huge sort of questions about all of that. But Harry said, if war comes, the workers will not be told it's a quarrel over markets and trade and fought out in the interests of the capitalists. They'll be told anything but that. The humbug, the liar, the press, the pulpit, the Labour leader, the Tory, the sincere and the insincere would join together to persuade the workers that it's a war to preserve peace and democracy and the independence of their nation. So I'll just leave it at that. Thanks for your time. Thanks for bearing with me. And, well, over to you now. Thank you.